Hello and welcome back to Whence Came You, a Freemasonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. I'm your host Robert Johnson, a York Rite Mason and Knight Templar. I guess there are some issues with the video I uploaded for the Royal Arch into the Whence Came You app. I'm working on that now. I hope to have it resolved by next week. Also, I wanted to mention that the Podcast Box app, which is for the Apple devices, and works a bit differently. When you download the app, you then have to do an in-app purchase to get the Whence Came You app. And you do that once for $2. But I have to say that it's quite a neat thing to see that so many of you have downloaded it and made it the number 4 most downloaded app in the purchases out of almost 200 different shows within that Podcast Box application. So for that, I just wanted to say thank you guys so very much. I'm running about a 101 fever right now, so this episode is going to be a little bit short, so we'll get right into it. This week I have an excerpt from an old publication called The Occult Review, and was published in October of 1909. Reason and Vision, a Review of Pluralistic Universe by Professor William James, 1909, Longmans, Green and Company, and Studies in Mystical Religion by Dr. Rufus M. Jones, 1909, Macmillan and Company, by W. L. Wilmshurst. There are two paths by which the human mind endeavors to approach the sanctuary of ultimate truth. The first, the more general, and as it eventually proves, the inadequate method, is that of reason, ordered, calculated thought based upon objective evidence and drawing its conclusions from within the limits of individual experience and from such phenomena as are found available. The faculty employed in this case is the rationalizing intellect, which as it works enacts its own laws of logic and evidence and formulates its own canons and criteria of judgment, thereby necessarily restricting its own capacities and conclusions to its own self-forged fetters. A formidable query mark, therefore, always stands opposite the results of rationalistic method, for firstly, the quantum of experience varies with individual minds, and secondly, the laws of logic applicable to one man's measure of experience are apt to break down when applied to another's. Follow the track of pure reason far enough and it leads to a position altogether impracticable and consistent with your own or someone else's personal experience. Again, we have schools of both materialistic and idealistic philosophy, and to leave the former entirely out of the account in the present consideration, the official professors of the latter are found to be seriously disunited in their conclusions. Does ultimate perfected truth already exist? They ask. Is something static and directly cognizable, or still in the process of making? Are things moving toward an assured divine event, or toward something undetermined and in futuro, the nature of which depends upon the way in which the totality of cosmic forces develop? Is deity already fully extant, and in control of the universe, are still only coming to birth concurrently with the universal evolutionary processes? Are the intermediate lords many and gods many? Is there an absolute behind encircling all? Even if monotheists, are we logically bound to be monists? Are there not strong reasons for being dualists, and still stronger ones being pluralists? So far, and into such perplexities, do reason and its organ, the logical intellect, even when committed to a spiritualistic view of things, lead us. The alternative and rarer method of approaching the final verities is by means of a faculty quite other than the reason, and indeed one in regard to which reason stands in constant conflict. It involves a direct act or state of consciousness which places the individual, though he touch but the hem of its garment, in first-hand relation with what he realizes irrefutably to be a permanent reality forming the woof of both himself and all else. Greek philosophy defined this faculty as the active reason, as opposed to the passive reason or carnal mind. It is the knower of Oriental religio-philosophy. It cognizes rather than intellectualizes, and it is, in fact, the only true and reliable organ of knowledge we possess. That it may be absurd or allowed to act ill-regulatedly is as unquestioned as that a ship's engines will race when the propeller they drive becomes lifted above the water it is intended to work in. But given a duly balanced human organism, it is the intuitive faculty that should control and inspire the reason, whereas the reverse method usually prevails, and the subordinate faculty is allowed to usurp the throne and dispossess the rightful king. Thus it ensues that the value of any man's philosophy depends more upon the measure of his illumination than upon that of his intellectual power. Where there is no vision, the people perisheth. Excess of intellectualism produces an inadequate philosophy. Illuminated reason alone can show us any good. As the Welsh mystic Thomas Vaughan quaintly puts it, it is a terrible thing to prefer Aristotle to the Elohim. Now the present position of the official philosophy taught in the academics of learning, and of which one phase is exhibited in Professor W. James' recent Guilford Lectures, just issued under the title of A Pluralistic Universe, is extremely interesting and suggestive, because many of its exponents, if not yet arrived at the summit of the Mount of Vision, seems assuredly to be traversing the lower slopes that lead thereto. This biggest and breeziest of philosophers realizes fully the value of transcendental experience as distinct from the more intellectualism. A man's vision is the great fact about him. He declares not his reasons, and since philosophy is essentially the vision of things seen from above, the wider the range of a man's consciousness, the greater the value to us of both himself and his philosophy. It is then from the standpoint of empiricism, that is, from the experiences of personal consciousness, that Professor James embarks upon a journey of protest against the monistic idealism obtaining in modern seats of philosophic learning. Briefly, his argument is this. An idealistic view of the universe may involve the following beliefs. 1. A dualistic theism, postulating God and man over against each other, a view which makes us outsiders and keeps us foreigners to God. His actions can affect us, but he can never be affected by our reaction. Not heart of our heart and reason of our reason, but our magistrate, rather. And 2. A pantheism involving intimacy between man and the creative principle, with which we may consider ourselves substantially one. The divine, the most intimate of all our possessions, heart of our heart, in fact. But this pantheistic belief can itself be subdivided into two forms. One, which conceives that the divine exists authentically only when the world is experienced all at once, in its absolute totality, which, it is urged, may never be actually experienced or realized in that shape at all. And another, which holds that the absolute may not at present exist, and that a disseminated, distributed, or incompletely unified appearance is the only form of reality may yet have achieved. It is this latter idea that Professor James champions at length, one that assumes a plurality of consciousness, as against a divine monoconsciousness, one that he claims, whilst making of God one of many conscious beings, affords the greater degree of intimacy for us, for the ideally perfect whole is one of which the parts are also perfect. But alas, we the parts are imperfect. Hence, if the world is, as it appears to be, still incomplete and unfinished, instead of believing in one absolute reality, is it not more rational to conceive reality as existing distributively, not yet in all, but in a set of eaches or pluralistically? But even if the idea of an absolute is dropped, is there no consciousness better than our own? Yes, the tenderer parts of personal life are continuous with more of the same quality operative in the universe outside us, and with which we may keep in working touch. We are continuous to our own consciousnesses at any rate, with a wider self from which saving experiences flow in. And here, because of such experiences, which reason would never have inferred in advance of their actual coming, but which, as they actually do come and are given, cause creation to widen to the view of the recipients. The professor finds himself obliged to break away from logic and intellectualism and stands ranged, in a quite literal sense, upon the side of the angels. The impetus of his own argument leads him to a belief similar to that held by the late German psychologist Fechner, in a pluralistic panpsychic universe teeming with superhuman life with which, unknown to ourselves, we are co-consciousness, angels and men ordained and constituted in a wonderful order, as old as the church collect has it. So there's the excerpt. I'll post the whole of the article on the app. Again, I apologize for not getting through the entirety of it. It is rather hard to follow sometimes because of the ideas contained within. However, I hope I did an okay job presenting it. Anyway, on we go, and this week's famous Freemason is Oliver Hardy, actor hailing from Solomon Lodge No. 20 in Florida. Oliver Hardy was born Norval Hardy in Harlem, Georgia. His father, Oliver, was a Confederate veteran wounded at the Battle of Antietam on September 17, 1862. After demobilization as a recruiting officer for Company K, 16th Georgia Regiment, The elder, Oliver Hardy, assisted his father in running the vestiges of the family cotton plantation, bought a share in a retail business, and was elected full-time tax collector for Columbia County. His mother, Emily Norville, the daughter of Thomas Benjamin Norville and Mary Freeman, was descended from Captain Hugh Norville of Williamsburg, Virginia. Her family arrived in Virginia before 1635. Their marriage took place on March 12, 1890. It was the second marriage for the widow, Emily, and the third for Oliver. He was of paternal English-American descent and maternal Scottish-American descent. The family moved to Madison in 1891, before Norville's birth. Norville's mother owned a house in Harlem, which was either empty or tenanted by her mother. It is probable that Norville was born in Harlem, though some sources say it was his mother's hometown, Covington. His father died less than a year after his birth. Hardy was the youngest of five children. A traumatic moment in his life was the death of his brother Sam Hardy in a drowning accident in the Oconee River. Hardy pulled his brother from the river but was unable to resuscitate him. As a child, Hardy was sometimes difficult. He was sent to Georgia Military College in Milledgeville as a youngster. In the 1905-1906 school year, fall semester, September through January, when he was 13, Hardy was sent to Young Harris College in North Georgia. However, he was in the junior high component of that institution, the equivalent of high school today, not the two-year college which exists today. He had little interest in education, although he acquired an early interest in music and theater, possibly from his mother's tenants. He joined a theatrical group and later ran away from a boarding school near Atlanta to sing with the group. His mother recognized his talent for singing and sent him to Atlanta to study music and voice with singing teacher Adolph Dom Peterson. But Hardy skipped some of his lessons to sing at the Alcazar Theater, a cinema, for $3.50 a week. He subsequently decided to go back to Milledgeville. Sometime prior to 1910, Hardy began styling himself Oliver Norville Hardy, with the first name Oliver being added as a tribute to his father. He appeared as Oliver N. Hardy in the 1910 U.S. Census, and in all subsequent legal records, marriage announcements, etc., Hardy used Oliver as his first name. Hardy's mother wanted him to attend the University of Georgia in the fall of 1912 to study law, but there's no evidence as to whether he did or not. Oliver Hardy, as a cabaret and vaudeville singer, he made his first movie, Outwitting Dad, in 1914. In 1917, he played a bit part in Lucky Dog, starring his future comedy partner Stan Laurel. Although it was not until 1927 in Sugar Daddies that they formed their on-screen partnership that was to last until Utopia in 1951. Hardy's screen character was noted for his genteel pomposity, his tie twiddle, and long-suffering look while dealing with Stan's character, and his well-meaning but ultimately frustrating on-screen antics. Oliver Hardy's ashes were interred in the Masonic Garden of Valhalla Memorial Park in North Hollywood. Laurel and Hardy appeared live on 1954 episode of This Is Your Life, where Hardy's Masonic membership is noted. It is unclear when he was initiated, however, he was a member of Solomon Lodge No. 20 in Jacksonville, Florida. He died August 7th, 1957. That's it for this week. Remember to find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Whence Came You. Add us to your circle on Google Plus at the email address wcypodcast@gmail.com, and feel free to email us at that same address. Visit the website wcypodcast.blogspot.com for links to everything for the show, including links to our mobile apps for Android and Apple devices. Until next week, for Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.